Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
In today's installment of my semi-regular series, What's It Really Like to Be Ah? We're going to do What's It Really Like to Be a Mathematician. I know that sounds boring. You're going to be tempted to change the channels, but my exchange with this guy suggests to me that it will be far from boring. With me to explore the issue of what is it really like to be a mathematician is Harvard and now UC Berkeley professor of mathematics, member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, author of the book, catch this, Love and Math, and perhaps more impressive to some people, he appeared on the Colbert Report, Edward Frankel from Istanbul. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Hello, it's good to be here with you, Marty.
It's amazing, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but there you are halfway around the world and you sound as clear as if you were in the next studio.
Right. It's amazing. I was just thinking the same thing, yes. Yeah.
It's remarkable, and yet it's old technology and yet it's still fabulous. In any case, was there a single moment when you decided to become a theoretical mathematician?
Yes, in fact, there was a sort of a pivotal moment when I fell in love with mathematics, if you will. And I was 15 years old, and in fact, I hated math at that point.
Hmm.
I was a high school student growing up in Russia in a small town near Moscow. And, well, I didn't hate it, really, but I thought mathematics was the most boring and, you know, irrelevant subject. Like you said, you know, when you say mathematics, people usually think it's going to be something boring.
Right.
So we'll see. We'll see what will happen.
Right.
But I thought the same thing. I thought the math was just the stuff that we studied at school, and I did not find it interesting at all. Even though I could do, you know, the exercises and solve the, you know, homework, etc.
The quadratic
but
equations.
Then something happened.
Okay.
And I was introduced to a friend of my parents who was a professional mathematician, and he was able to show me that, you know, math is a lot bigger and a lot more fascinating than I knew. But in fact, there was something, there was a catch. So there was one thing which I was really excited about, and that was quantum physics. I was really excited about physics, about elementary particles. And as a kid, I was reading, you know, popular books about it and so on. And so he sort of used it, his friend of my parents, he sort of used it as a hook, and he said, okay, so you like quantum physics, but how do you think physicists are able to theorize all these particles and all these forces, etc.? And I didn't really know, because in the books they explain some stuff, but not in detail. And so I remember that moment vividly, when he pulled out a book from a shelf, and he opened it, and I saw that, you know, it was almost like written in a different language. I couldn't make heads or tails of it, but it was clear to me that that book contained explanations, and it was a mathematical book. So the language of that stuff that I was so excited about was mathematics. And he said to me at that moment, he said, you think what you study at school is mathematics? He said, no, this is mathematics. And I remember at that moment, I was like, wow, I really want to know that.
So it was that you were, so there were these little subatomic particles called mesons and quarks, and which are we're not able to see, but we infer their existence from mathematics. And it was your curiosity to find out how the hell do we know this thing exists called a quark that got you interested.
Exactly. And in fact, so in my, you mentioned my book. In my book at the very beginning, I explained how it works, you know, that actually a physicist who theorized quarks are these tiny little particles which are the constituents of protons and neutrons and some other elementary particles, which were thought to be indivisible, you know, the truly elementary particles, building blocks of nature. And yet, you know, Murray Gell-Mann, the physicist, was able to figure out that actually inside a proton, inside a neutron, were hiding these little tiny particles, which in fact is like kind of weird that the force between them is so strong that you cannot really pull them apart. And yet he was able to divine, you know, to figure out that these particles were there. And how did he do it? He used a very sophisticated mathematical theory, a mathematical theory of symmetry.
And do you have an intuition as to whether, just like, you know, in probably in the 18th century, we thought that the atom was the smallest unit, and then it was the electron, and now it's the meson and the quark. Do you think that 50 years from now they'll find an even smaller particle?
Well, perhaps. I mean, already today there are various theories which are still very, you know, speculative, such as string theory,
right,
in which, you know, the fundamental objects are not even particles, but are extended objects, one-dimensional, like strings, like, you know, like a little vibrating, you know, thing. And so, in other words, it's not clear at all that, in fact, the world is built of particles. In fact, we know that it's not. There is no sense in which anything that you have, you know, a table at which I'm sitting right now, or, you know, a pen, is a bag of particles, is a collection of particles, because we know from quantum mechanics that every particle is also a wave.
Right.
It's sort of a lump of energy which is spread out throughout space and time. And so it's a lot more complex. So, for instance, in string theory, what physicists observe in experiments, such as at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, which was in the news lately, you know, all those particles actually are nothing but vibrations of a string. And so, like, just like notes of different instruments, you know, are vibrations of a string, say, of a violin. And so, in other words, the deeper we look into matter and into nature, the more we get surprised, because our naive expectations and our naive views of the world as being completely break it into pieces and the whole is just the sum of its parts. Well, now we know for sure it's not the case. It's a lot more complex.
So how does a human being, as well as a mathematician, make peace with the fact that the elemental entity through in which we exist is vibrations? How does that affect your worldview?
Well, you know, but to be honest, it's the worldview that we have today. I would call it Cartesianism. So it goes back to Descartes, 400 years ago. It's this idea of sort of mechanistic, deterministic world, which is sort of like a bunch of billiard balls which are flying around and hitting each other. You know, so that was the understanding the scientists had 400 years ago. And now it has become our, I almost want to say, a dogma, kind of a dogmatic view of the world. It's a very simple way to think. And in fact, it's useful to think this way, you know, for various purposes. But the reality is much more complex. And the point is that as humanity evolves, you know, it's interesting how there is sort of a shift of paradigms. For instance, in 17th century, when Descartes proposed his ideas, right? So the scientific view of the world was very simplistic, but people were also more spiritual, I would say. So people, for example, believed in God. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but people accepted that there is something ineffable, it's something that cannot be explained. And so, in some sense, you had these two sides. So on the one hand, they did accept something infinite and something unmanifested, but then also the view of the world was simplistic. Now, today, an interesting thing has happened, which is that, you know, today we don't believe in God, or many of us don't, right? And so it's sort of like we would like to have a scientific point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But the funny thing is that we are still clinging to the science of the 17th century. You see, but science has evolved, and so in fact science now tells us stuff which is a lot more spooky and mystical than anything religion used to tell us, you know, like things like vibrating energy and so on, right? So it's almost like a source. Science, therefore, could be a source of spirituality today, I think, if we take it seriously.
Is it? Now, there's always been that which is not understandable. I mean, the fact that a cell can grow into a human being is at this point inexplicable. The fact that electrons are both particles and waves. What in the world caused the first natural object? But is that really a source of spirituality, or is that merely say that in the year 2015, science is not advanced enough to understand it? Why would that be a basis for spirituality any more than when in spontaneous generation, where they had the jar that was closed with a piece of meat in it, apparently they thought spontaneously generated were these flies, when in fact they simply didn't have a microscope yet? Why is that a basis for spirituality rather than simply say, hey, 2015, science has only come so far?
Well, that's right. Well, that is a crucial question. And it's, there isn't a simple answer to this. But I think that we have convinced ourselves somehow that everything can be explained. And, you know, and there is a reason for that, because science has been incredibly successful in explaining things, in building things, in advancing our technology. Ever since Descartes, in fact, it sort of launched the age of enlightenment and industrial revolution and so on. All the good stuff has come out, but also notice how much bad stuff has come out, how much destruction, how much death,
sure.
You know, and the world wars, you know, yeah. Atomic bomb, et cetera.
Right.
So it's a double-edged sword. But what I feel like we're losing is this almost like sort of this innocence of a child who doesn't know yet the explanations and yet is connected to the world. He does not consider himself or herself as separate from the world. And I think as we grow up, we kind of withdraw, you know, because we start defending ourselves because of various experiences that we have, traumatic experiences. You know, as children, we are small physically, and so we have to protect ourselves. And as years go by, we become more and more withdrawn, and we feel more and more separate from the world. And then it becomes an issue of control. So ultimately, I think what the reason why we would like to have this idea that everything can be explained is because that gives us this idea, this sense of control, that if we can explain that, we can control it, right? And if we accept that something cannot be explained, then, oh my gosh, so then how can we control it? Maybe we can't control it. So that's a very interesting, you know, dynamics here. And what I think is happening also is that today we kind of have appointed scientists as our new gurus, you know, and as a kind of, someone used this word, torchbearers, you know, our new torchbearers. So it's not a priest anymore or a guru, it's a scientist. But I'm not sure that we are qualified, quite frankly, because what we have done, we have been incredibly successful, we scientists have been incredibly successful in a particular way. But it doesn't mean that we can actually, you know, reach out for the infinite, for the deepest understanding of life.
What makes me sad in a way is that indeed religion and a sense of mastery of the universe and understanding is comforting. And so I think the way that people today address that is by trying to control the small sphere of influence. And in many cases, yes. To me, that's defined, for example, by an eating disorder. Somebody can control how much they put into their stomach. That doesn't require any externalities. And so that they've been saying that things like eating disorders are caused by our desire for control, or we become control our interaction through the use of social media, so that we might use Facebook or LinkedIn to control our interactions with folks. There's less
this. That's right, because we don't want to experience pain of, you know, personal relationships, because when there is a personal relationship, it could be,
yep,
wonderful, and it could give us incredible gifts,
yes,
you know, of love, etc. But we could also experience pain. It's a whole,
right,
spectrum.
Right, exactly.
We might want to protect ourselves.
Exactly. You, dear listeners, you might wonder what the hell you're listening to. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. We're talking about what it's really like to be a mathematician with Harvard and now UC Berkeley professor, mathematician, and author of the book Love and Math, Edward Frankel. But I have deliberately, because this is a smart, interesting guy, I've deliberately let ourselves go on a little bit of a tangent, because these foundational issues are interesting. And, you know, no smart person ends up being this narrow technician who's merely studying the fourth dimension in topography. One of the defining characteristics of a bright person is a multivariate interest, and Edward Frankel is a perfect example of that. But let us go back to the core question of what is it really like to be a mathematician. You're working on perhaps the most famous mathematical project that nobody's ever heard of. It's called the Langlands Program. It's an attempt to create a grand unifying theory of mathematics to try to give us a window into what a theoretical mathematician actually does. What is the problem within that you are currently grappling with?
Okay, yes. So let me tell you a little bit about this subject. So Langlands program is named after a mathematician, Robert Langlands. He's a Canadian-born mathematician who is a professor at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. And that's it's a venerable institution,
of
which
course.
Was home for
Einstein,
the last 3 years of his life, etc. And in fact, Langlands today occupies Einstein's former office at this institute. And so I sometimes quip, you know, that everybody knows who Einstein is, but very few people know who Langlands is, even though his work may be just as important as Einstein's. But it's more abstract, you know, it's more mathematical. Einstein's work is more easier to explain. You know, you talk about light, a ray of light bending around a star. It's something that we can all appreciate and grasp immediately. When you talk about these abstract concepts that appear in the Langlands program, it takes an effort to explain. So, but what it is in essence is an attempt to connect different parts of mathematics. And here the first thing to realize is that mathematics is not just one lump of knowledge, but in fact there are different subjects within mathematics. There are different disciplines. For instance, number theory, the study of numbers and various equations related to numbers, and the kind of numbers which appear are not just the usual numbers such as 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., or even, you know, fractions, etc., but there are more sophisticated numerical systems as well which are being studied. That's one subject. Another one is...
What's one other numerical system other than 1, 2, 3, 4, and fractions?
Oh, okay, well, so think about binaries, like 0 and 1, right?
Like the computer basic
assembly
language.
So you only have two numbers, 0 and 1, but you can do arithmetic with them.
Yes.
0 plus 0 is 0, 0 plus 1 is 1. 1 plus 1. What is 1 plus 1? Well, normally we say 2. But in the binary system, we say it's 0. 1 plus 1 is 0. It's like negation of a negation, you know, is nothing. So
they cancel each other out, yeah.
And that's right, they cancel each other out. And so likewise, you can also take the product 0 times 0 is 0, 0 times 1 is 0, 1 times 1 is 1. So there you got yourself a numerical system. You have only two elements, 0 and 1. But you can do arithmetic with them. You can add them and multiply. And these two operations satisfy the same rules that the usual operations of addition and multiplication of sort of regular numbers that we're used to. So here's an example of a kind of a slightly exotic, you know, esoteric numerical system. And
right.
There are many more like that. So that's number theory. Then you got geometry, for instance.
Right.
That's a study of shapes and forms. Then you also have analysis.
Hold on, let's stay there. I mean, you know, that's something that you talked about mathematics being fascinating or whatever. But when I think about geometry, I think of, you know, deriving geometry, I'm thinking of, you know, various kinds of geometry of the tetrahedron or the cone or whatever. Why should we care about that?
Right. Okay, so there are several layers here. First of all, the kind of geometry we get exposed to in school is what's called Euclidean geometry.
Right.
So it goes back to Euclid's work, which is called Elements, which was published 2,300 years ago. 2,300 years ago. And geometry has advanced tremendously since then. There is also non-Euclidean geometry. And I know it sounds like it's something terribly complicated, but it's not. It's just that in Euclidean geometry, you consider sort of flat things. So you consider, you know, imagine a tabletop and extend it in all directions. So you get what mathematicians call a plane, okay? And then on this plane, you can draw lines and triangles and circles and things like that. That's what we study at school when we study Euclidean geometry. Now imagine that you replace the plane by a sphere. So take the globe, for example.
Right.
Right? And in fact, it's more realistic even because obviously the Earth is not flat, right? We know that it's spherical. So what do we have on a sphere? On a sphere, we have meridians, parallels. So these are the objects which replace lines and triangles, etc. And in fact, they're much more fun to work with, to study. And so what's really, you know, one of my complaints usually when I talk about math education today is that how come we only study geometry as it was known 2,300 years ago, 2,300 years ago? It is like studying in a literature class only Homer, Odyssey, and Iliad. Which, by the way, Homer lived 2,500 years ago, so more or less the same time period as Euclid. So imagine that in our literature classes, we only study Homer, and that's it. There is no Salinger, you know, T.S. Eliot, Melville, no, nothing, just Homer. Okay, and I'm not against Homer. I love Homer. He laid the foundations of the Western canon of literature, as did Euclid with his work Elements. But mathematics has advanced. And we have to keep up with it. And we have to give our children the opportunity to know what mathematics is really about.
In fact, two things. We'll get to the opportunity cost of teaching that, whether even if it be the cone or the tetrahedron or the sphere, you know, the opportunity cost of that learning in school and whether really that is fascinating enough, whether, you know, adding a dimension let alone 13 dimensions, as we'll get to in a moment, is enough to generate interest. By the way, what really is that, you're studying the fourth dimension as I was reading your stuff. You're studying, what the hell is the fourth dimension? I understand there are some scientists studying 13 dimensions.
Oh, yeah. Well, we can study even infinite dimensional spaces, believe it or not. So, first of all, we can have a space of any dimension, 100, 1,000, billion, whatever. But actually, you know, it's not so... it's something that we... For example, if you use a spreadsheet program, you know, like Excel.
Yeah.
So each row is going to be a collection of numbers, right? So like a lot of people use that in their daily lives.
Yeah.
Like when you reconcile your banking, you know, statements, etc. So you have a bunch of numbers. So now imagine that this row, so let's say it has, you know, 10 numbers. In each row you have 10 numbers. So you can think of these 10 numbers as 10 coordinates of a point in a 10-dimensional space. So there you have yourself, once you start doing a spreadsheet a program, you are doing studying something in 10-dimensional, whatever, n-dimensional space, you see. So it's not, it sounds more scary than it is. But going back to math education, I think, because you asked something important, you know, you said, why do we need to put, to you know...
How do we justify it given the opportunity cost, the teaching of the area of a cone, of the volume of a cone?
And, you know, unfortunately, the state of our math education in the United States is really atrocious. And there are many things, but I think one of the main issues is, and we have to really admit it once and for all, that most of our children get traumatized in our math classes.
Sure.
It's really childhood trauma. And
absolutely,
that's why people say they hate mathematics. Because, you know, it only takes one experience of being called by an unscrupulous teacher to the blackboard and being asked to solve an equation, and you're not able to do it, and then the teacher says you're stupid in front of the class. It only takes one such experience to, you know, to be afraid of mathematics forever. And then every time the subject comes up, to run away from it and say, I hate it, it's boring, it's terrible, etc. It's a very basic mechanism, defense mechanism that we have.
But I want to interrupt you, because, you know, that's bad teach somebody that bad, you're stupid. That's not why people are turned off to math. The more typical reason the typical people are turned off to math is that it is very abstract. It is hard to tie it to reality. You are learning, whether it be in two-dimensional or three-dimensional space, you are learning the areas of how to manipulate the geometry of a cone or its quadratic equations or whatever. How can you justify, in an era in which so many people graduate high school and college unable to even make a reasonable communicative argument verbally, as they'll have to do in any job, how can we justify the opportunity cost of making kids learn algebra, geometry, and calculus?
Because we make them learn stuff which perhaps they shouldn't be learning, which is what I said earlier about Euclidean geometry. Why do we keep teaching the same stuff for 2,000 years?
What would you teach? What would Edward Frankel, if you were in, it's now day one, school is about to start, we're at the end of August, you are now thrust into a ninth grade, in what's normal, eighth grade, ninth grade, tenth grade.
Even earlier, you know, I have gone to schools. I have gone to a school in New York, Aspire Legacy School, and I talked to, you know, 10, 11, 12-year-old students. And I talk to them about the sphere, geometry of a sphere. I talk to them about these numerical systems, like the binaries we talked about earlier.
Can we role play for a moment? Let's say whatever grade you want, seventh, eighth, ninth. It is, you are now teleported from your job as professor of math, and you're going to be teaching, say, seventh grade math.
Yes.
And it's the day you're going to be doing it for the full year. It is now the first lesson that you're going to teach. What's your first lesson going to be? Do it.
Well, there are a bunch of things. I'm going to start by showing what mathematics is really about, by showing glimpses of mathematics, and we have discussed some of them, such as non-Euclidean geometry, such as exotic numerical systems, and also symmetry. I mentioned earlier when we talked about elementary particles. This is something which has nothing to do with numbers, it's nothing to do with calculations and procedures, which is how, by the way, mathematics is usually presented. It's just a bunch of calculational procedures that need to be memorized and then forgotten after the exam, unfortunately, right? So symmetry is a very intuitive concept of, you know, like rotations, imagine like rotations of a sphere, things like that, or rotations of a Rubik's Cube. I went to that school, Aspire Legacy School in New York, and I talked to the kids about Rubik's Cube. And guess what? Half of them knew how to solve it. Not me. I cannot solve it. They can solve it. And they can learn stuff much faster than adults, you know, much faster than you can explain it to them, if you motivate them. Now, how do you motivate them? And you're absolutely right. There has to be a connection. If the way mathematics is presented today is presented in too abstract way and disconnected from reality. But it is connected to reality. So many things today are based on mathematics. All of our technology, computers, internet, smartphones, all the algorithms which are secretly at work when we go buy a book on Amazon or rent a movie on Netflix. How can we not mention this stuff when we teach mathematics in schools today?
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I'm talking with formerly Harvard and now UC Berkeley professor and mathematician Edward Frankel. He's also of a book that attempts to make math beloved called Love and Math. I'd like to turn to something in our email exchange before our this interview. We had and you had me watch some videos of yours, which I loved. I want to turn to artificial intelligence because, of course, mm-hmm. math is at the core of it. A core assumption in this thing called artificial intelligence is that cognition, thinking, can be reduced to the zeros and ones of computer assembly language. Well, that's what computers are based on, zeros and ones, as you said earlier.
Correct.
Do you think that enough of cognition can eventually be characterized in terms of zeros and ones so that artificial intelligence will actually replace jobs requiring high intelligence or even average intelligence?
Well, that's a very important question, and I think we don't talk about this enough. And the stuff is happening at a lightning speed right now, and we have to catch up. You know, we have to become more aware of what's going on. So let me say a few things. So first of all, when we say artificial intelligence, we have to separate two things. One is what's called sort of a narrow artificial intelligence, which is specific algorithms which are designed to do some specific tasks, such as translation. You know, so you have Google Translate, which I use all the time, mm-hmm. which is getting better and better, mm-hmm. Where you put a phrase in one language and it gives you, it searches through its database and finds the closest one that it has and gives you translation. And so it's actually sometimes it's very good. It's not yet perfect, but it's
sure.
getting better.
It's okay. Amazing.
So that's
yeah.
narrow artificial intelligence.
Right.
Then the people also talk about what's sometimes called AGI, so artificial general intelligence. And that's the idea of having sort of a computer which is reproducing essentially the consciousness of a human.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a big debate about this, and so whether it is possible or not. And I think that and a number of prominent people such as Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking have warned us lately that it's, you know, that artificial intelligence, or also known as AI, when they say that, they actually mean AGI, artificial
right.
general intelligence,
right.
is, as Elon Musk put it, is the biggest existential threat to humanity. And Stephen Hawking said that could spell the end of human race, even. You know, so in other words, there is a lot of concern and a lot of alarm about that. And so the question that I am interested in as a mathematician is whether it is actually possible
right.
to do that, to represent.
Let me paint a picture of what we're talking about. You remember the movie 2001, in which the HAL 9000
right.
computer
yes.
ended up taking over the ship and therefore was able to use it for nefarious goals. It was
that's
smarter,
right.
essentially. It was more efficacious than the humans. And that's
right.
the fear, that computers will get smarter than humans and therefore, for good or for evil, will control the world. Is that a fair
but,
summary?
Well, we program the computers, but the consequences, we could be some unforeseen consequences of that, right?
Right.
And I think HAL 9000, the computer on board of that spaceship in 2001, Space Odyssey by Kubrick, which is a very prescient movie,
right.
1968, but
right. amazing.
Kind of like, he is a very good metaphor. I mean, it's not exactly the problem. There is also a problem with this discussion that usually when people start talking about artificial intelligence, we very quickly kind of fall into this trap of like science fiction movies, which kind of creates this illusion that we are talking about science fiction and not something that's happening
mm-hmm.
in reality today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But actually, it is happening in reality today because there are already, you know, there is already a possibility of self-guided missile systems in which, a computer connected to a drone could make a decision about launching a strike without human supervision. This already exists. And, you know, one of my colleagues at UC Berkeley recently, has has warned in Nature magazine about this threat. You know that we have to. There is sort of like a new arms race now in this kind of in this kind of autonomous weapon systems. You see, so this is something very real. It's not at all. You know, Russell Stewart is the name of my colleague at UC Berkeley, and he said that deployment of lethal autonomous weapon system is feasible within years, not decades.
Before we get to the feasibility question, I'm curious about the following. Every technology, including atomic technology, has its upsides and downsides. From a mathematical probabilistic perspective, do you have any intuitions as to whether the net effects of AGI, artificial general intelligence, is going to be a net positive or net negative, or is it too likely that there could be an Armageddon scenario that it's worth ignoring the positives? What are your thoughts about that?
Right. So I think you're asking the right question. So to me, I think what is lacking sometimes from this debate, from these discussions, is that we are talking about this issue as an issue of robots and the future. What kind of robots we will build in the future? But I think the question should be framed as a question about us, about humans, and about now, about the present, not about the future, about who we are, about who we want to be. Where do we want to take humanity? And this actually is closely connected to what we talked about earlier, because this idea of rationality, of rational explanation, of over-explaining and controlling everything, is what gives us this naive sort of point of view and a naive expectation that actually a human is nothing but a computer. That, you know, but what is a computer? A computer is essentially a machine which performs an algorithm. An algorithm is a step-by-step procedure, like long division. So there are certain tasks which we humans do, which could be broken down into steps. But can everything really be explained? And I think this is a question that each of us should ask himself or herself. In other words, I will never be able to convince somebody that he or she is not a computer, is not an algorithm. They have to know it themselves. I know I am not. You see, so this is the only thing I can say for sure. I'm not a machine. And I have my reasons for that, you know, so I do know that there are certain things in my life which cannot be explained by algorithms, such as love, for example, which I think, you know, we rationalize love. We say, oh, you know, I fall in love because of this and this and this. You know, I recently talked to somebody. It was kind of funny because she said, well, I always fall in love for a reason. And I said, well, haven't you ever fallen in love at first sight? And she said, yes, I did, but it was also for a reason, you know. But it's ridiculous because you cannot have any reason. At first sight, by definition, means you have no information about the other person, you see.
You know, there's a certain irony in what you're doing. You're really reducing this to ones and zeros. It's not whether everything can be reduced to an algorithm, but whether in net we can reduce enough to an algorithm. Like, I teach in the medical school at UCSF, and I am dispirited by how imprecise medical diagnosis and treatment is, even when they do it right, forgetting about the countless errors that occur in hospitals. Yeah. So a more general artificial intelligence, not just a narrow algorithm like translation, could save millions and millions of lives.
But it also leads us astray, you see, because how come that the most prescribed medicine is antidepressants today? You know, that's the road to rationality. Because, you know, on the one hand, we are constantly telling ourselves that we can control everything. You know, we can rationalize everything, but what it leads us is it leads us to anxiety, to being unhappy, to suffering, right? So it's always like that. There are always two sides. And, you know, and in my book, I describe, you know, when I was 17, 18, I worked with medical doctors in Moscow. I worked on developing algorithms for medical diagnosis, because I wanted to be able to formulate something that more experienced doctors could see, which less experienced doctors didn't know, so that this algorithm could help them make diagnosis.
Right.
But it's never foolproof. It's never 100%.
Sure.
And I think the danger today is that we kind of start thinking of a human as just sort of like a bunch of metabolic pathways which can be analyzed mathematically, and so you can describe everything and analyze everything. And of course, it's very useful. Like I said, you know, I'm the last person to criticize it. I did work on this stuff 25 years ago when very few people worked on this, you know. So I know how it works, and it could be very efficient. But I'm sorry, we still need doctors, we still need humans who can actually have intuition about stuff, who can have an instinct about stuff, which no algorithm will ever have. So you're right. A lot of things can be described by numerical procedures, and we have to use this you know, this algorithm should be at the service of humanity and not the other way around. And what I see today is the opposite process. When we are becoming machines, why are we becoming machines? Because we start believing that we're machines. And let me tell you, Marty, I think that if you believe that you are a machine, you are already a machine in some sense, because you're already losing your essence as a human.
I want to push this in one other direction. There is an a priori assumption in what you say that we are better off if we are human than if we aspire to be machine-like. How clear is it that that's true?
That we don't aspire to be
machine-like. Is it possible that, let's say there were two clones of Edward Frankel, and one clone aspired to be quintessentially human, to feel the ineffable, to feel love, to acknowledge the uncertainties, and the other's primary driver is, I want to be as machine-like as possible, while fully recognizing I will never be a full machine, but I'm better off being as machine-like as possible. Is it clear which of those two clones is going to be a wiser way to exist?
But there is no absolute here, you see. It's a good question. So you see, because the point is, I was like that. And I think now I kind of see that the reason why I became a mathematician was to find an escape, in some sense, from reality. Because it is, mathematics is this very pure, beautiful world where you cannot be touched by bigots, you know, and by bullies, etc. You know, you cannot be hurt. That's why we choose the subject. We choose science is a way to escape also. So in many ways, I was, you know, for many years, I was doing mathematics. I was very focused on mathematics. And it took me a long time to sort of go back to my roots. I don't want to go too, you know, spiritual and you or whatever, as a kind of connect to my roots. But, I mean, this is what it feels like when you finally connect to your childhood experiences and you start understanding what the mechanisms of certain things and hang-ups that you have. I'm talking about myself personally, you know. So when I go back and connect to my own pain of past traumas and past experiences, that's when I realize why I do certain things, why I try to escape, why I try to rationalize, why I try to pretend that I can control things, you see. So it's not a matter. I think that each of us is in essence infinite. It has a lot more than the proverbial left brain, which gives us a capacity to logically reason logically and, you know, calculate and etc. and analyze and overanalyze and rationalize, which, by the way, is very important. I'm not saying it's not important. Of course it's important. I'm a mathematician, for goodness sake, of course. I do it for a living. But it's only a left brain, so to speak, and I mean it in a proverbial sense. There is also right brain. There is also intuition. There is also instinct. And we should stop running away from it, because otherwise we have a lopsided life and we become like HAL 9000, you know, when this logical side takes over and kind of dominates and suppresses our true nature.
I want to challenge this. It is an important notion. We as an if I as an individual, I'm more fully understanding of my existence. If I look to the childhood roots of my angst, and in your case, you suffered anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union, and but I've seen many people who end up spending years in therapy to try to get in touch with that pain, but end up as a result net-net being more self-absorbed, more mired in the past, actually less happy and less likely to make a difference in the world. I tend to be utilitarian because I think that Marty Nemko, doesn't matter squat. I'm one of 7.3 billion people on the planet. So to the extent to which I am rational and able to fully function and suppress all of the childhood angst, I may not be so fully understanding of myself, but I'm going to make a bigger difference in the world. Do you disagree with that?
Well, first of all, I disagree that you are just one of a few billion people. You are the most important person in the world. Each of us is. Each of us is individual. Each of us is a human. And each of us is infinite in essence, you see. And so that is the problem, that we kind of start talking about statistics and averages, but I never met an average person. I always meet someone. If I meet someone, that person is special. Each of us is special. And the question is a personal question. Who do you want to be, Marty? Do you want to be an efficient member of society, a little cog in a big machine? Or do you want to connect to yourself, to your infinite essence, you know? That is the question. And so, but there is no formula, you see. So what works for me may not work for you or for someone else. But I know for me, it was very important to connect to my childhood traumas, to my childhood pain. And you mentioned, you know, when I was 16 years old, and I was, you know, it was a year after I had this revelation, this revelatory moment when I fell in love with mathematics, and I wanted to study mathematics in Moscow, and there was the only school to do that was Moscow University, and because my father is Jewish, my last name is Jewish, I was failed ruthlessly, as were hundreds and thousands of other kids, 16, 17 year olds. You know, they didn't just tell us, "Oh, you're Jewish, we're not going to accept you." They actually subjected us to cruel 4 or 5 hour exams where we were given unfair treatment and questions which went far beyond the program, etc. So a lot of people were destroyed by this. And so I obviously survived. And so, in fact, in many ways, it gave me motivation to, you know, to study and to be better, because I wanted to prove to them that they could not stop me. And, you know, 5 years after that exam, I was invited to Harvard as a visiting professor. I was 21, right? But, you know, all these years, I told myself this story that I was just so strong, you know. I was just so strong when I was 16 that even though I was treated in this very unfair way, cruel way, but I was able to kind of persevere. And it only about a year ago, I was able to connect to that pain, which I now realize was hiding inside me for many years. And it was, you know, every once in a while was bubbling up and coming up to the surface. And so what really happens, I think, with us when we're children, there are certain experiences which are just too overwhelming for us. We are just not ready to deal with them. And so we simply don't accept when something really painful happens, like what happened to me when I was 16. We don't accept. We cannot accept it. But how can you not accept? It's reality. So what happens is that what psychologists call is kind of what happens is kind of a splitting, a kind of dissociation. A part of you goes into the unconscious. It kind of gets suppressed. And then for me, this I see now very clearly, it required sort of severing some connection, my emotional connections to the world. By the way, great movie recently, you may have seen, Inside Out.
Yes, of course, yeah.
Which speaks about that.
Right,
and,
it does.
You know, when I saw that moment when those islands started crumbling down, you know, I cried because it was me. I recognize myself, and I think we all, to some extent, go through that, which is not, it's not a bad thing, or it's not a good or bad thing. It's, in some sense, it is how it is. This is what makes us who we are. But only if, when we become strong, finally, when we grow up and we become strong, if we actually go back and revisit that child and find that child and hold her hand and bring them back.
You know, there is an interesting implicit thing. You know, you mentioned the fact that they told you that you couldn't was what motivated you to do. That is exactly opposite to standard psychological theory that says we should positively reinforce, that praise results in more of that behavior. Yeah. You get more of what you praise. And yet I have heard again and again of people's, the driver to becoming successful was to prove somebody wrong.
That's right. And that's exactly the point. So I think it's very important for us, for each of us, to accept ourselves as we are. And it means, because, you know, I heard many times people say, you have to love yourself. And it sounds great, but like, what does it mean? So what I realize what it means is that I had to love that 16-year-old boy who was waiting for me to come back and take his pain and let it out, you see. And so, but what you say, you know, like positive reinforcement and so on, it doesn't work by itself. And it only proves my point, which is that there is no formula. When it comes to human relations, when it comes to our humanity, we are such complex and such vulnerable creatures. There is no algorithm. There is no formula for us to be happy or whatever, you know? And even to me, I believe it's this discussion about happiness. It's a bit misleading also, because we also go, are you happy? Are you unhappy? I think the real question is whether you accept or resist reality. This is what the axis, to be a little mathematical, this is sort of the axis. On one side is resistance, and the other side is acceptance. And acceptance, the most difficult thing, is accept yourself and accept what happened to you, for example, in the past when you're a child. And so, and I know, you're right, a lot of people, we suppress this stuff. We suppress, and of course, we can be efficient members of society, etc. And that pain, which is inside, it could be a driving force for us. But we are not complete. I think we are not complete until and unless we connect to that pain and let it out. And that's when we become whole.
I think that really is just one of two possible approaches. I think I've just seen, you know, is it more important that Marty Nemco be whole? Or is it that more important that Marty Nemco, even if he's unhappy, contribute more to the world? And well, as a utilitarian,
this is a question for you, Marty.
Yeah.
This is a question for you. I cannot answer for you. You see,
right.
This is the point. Nobody, you cannot set up an experiment, you know, like you cannot create a machine, like some experimental apparatus, which will answer this question for you. You have to look inside yourself, and you have to answer for yourself. I know for myself, I want to know the truth about myself. You can ask me why. Why do I need to know? Why did I need to connect to my pain as a 16-year-old? I lived happily for 30 years, and then suddenly I was, you know, it was like a tsunami of pain came and completely overtook me for some time. But it passes, you know, it passes. It the pain is finite. It comes out, and you feel different, and you start seeing things which you didn't see before. So I know for myself, if there is something like that still left in me, there is some, you know, past experiences which I'm not yet connected, I would like to connect to them. I would like to know. But I realize that some people don't want, and I understand why, because the immediate effect is pain. There is a short-term pain, but, you know, like as they say, no pain, no gain. But then there is a long-term gain. But you have to decide yourself.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I am talking with UC Berkeley mathematician, professor of mathematics, and member of the American Academy of Sciences, and author of the book Love and Math. You can see at his core, this man may be trained as a mathematician and is an absolutely top-notch mathematician, but at his core, he is about the feelings. How interesting that we have a mathematician who at his core is about the ineffable.
yes.
Right? I'd like to now give my...
Well, I'm a kind of a reformed mathematician, you might say.
Right, exactly. I want to give our listeners a chance to ask you a question or two. So, dear listeners, if you've been listening to this discussion and you have a question for Edward Frankel about what it's really like to be a very human mathematician, I invite you to call. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And even before I finish giving out the phone number, there's callers on the line. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. What is your question or comment for Edward Frankel?
Hi, thanks for the interview. I'd be interested to know whether your guest, Mr. Frankel, has any thoughts on that he's willing to disclose on how a new, ever more exclusive knowledge, perhaps based on a, say, molecular chip, so to speak, might be acquired by an exclusive class of people, say, analogous to the people who hold great wealth today and are more or less out of sight of the operations of society. How those forces might combine to create a dual class system.
Mm-hmm. Very good question. Excellent question. Yes, I think there's a lot of cause for alarm today, and one of the reasons is what happens in genomics and today in biology, but also in artificial intelligence, what we talked about earlier. And you know, let me just give you one example. The person who is in charge of artificial development and research in artificial intelligence at Google, which of course we all know is the biggest information technology
Ray Kurzweil,
in the world,
yeah.
is Ray Kurzweil,
yeah.
who was appointed about two, three years ago as their director of engineering, in charge of artificial intelligence. This man is on record, you know, talking about so-called technological singularity in a number of books that he has written, which were very successful, in which he talks about that by the year 2045, we will be able to transfer our, you know, create robots basically, onto which we will be able to transfer our minds, our consciousness, and so we become sort of machines. You see, and so this man, there are many interesting details. If you Google him, you know, you will find a lot of interesting stuff about him. For example, he takes between 150 and 200 pills a day because he wants to survive to the year 2045. Because, of course, you know, he will be 97 in 2045. So what a shame it would be if he dies in 2044. So he will not be able to, in that case, to transfer himself into a robot, you know. So he also wants to resurrect his father. So he has collected all this stuff about his father. He wants to create his father as a robot, etc. So now, all of this stuff is fascinating. It could be fascinating in a movie, etc. But now, imagine that this man is actually in charge of artificial intelligence at the world's biggest information technology corporation. And nobody's talking about this. So what I would like to know is what the top brass at Google, people like Larry Page, think about these ideas. Do they agree? Do they also think that humans are nothing but machines and that we will eventually transfer ourselves onto robots, etc.? Or, if not, then how can they have somebody like that, a figure like that, having such a an important position in their company, which, by the way, has very little oversight in what they do in artificial intelligence. They are buying left and right. They're buying robotics companies. They're buying artificial intelligence companies, investing in artificial intelligence companies. They bought DeepMind for more than $500 million a year and a half ago. And at that time, they said that they would create an ethics board about, on the questions of artificial intelligence. Well, guess what? I Googled Google's ethics board, and I couldn't find anything, no information. There's very little oversight. So, you know, why are we not talking about this stuff? And I agree with your caller that, you know, we now are in this very dangerous situation, which I think is kind of unprecedented, when our technology has gotten to the point where we can manipulate a lot of things related to humans. And even if we, you know, even if we cannot, as I believe, and as I argued recently, you know, on mathematical grounds, that we cannot reproduce our consciousness by an algorithm. And it's not just me. Many prominent mathematicians and scientists have spoken about this, based on some mathematical theorems such as Gödel's incompleteness theorem, etc.
You know, I want to refocus the, you know, the caller's question was about, is this going to exacerbate, you know, essentially like income inequality in that the, you know, the technology gap between the haves and have-nots.
But I think he was more broad than just income inequality.
No, I mean, right, you know, but I mean just haves and have-nots. I mean, for example...
For sure, of course.
But Google...
I mean, as far as... income inequality. There are many other means by
sure.
which, you know, misuse of technology in today's world. You know, we're eliminating whole professions. You know, and you know, my good friend Jaron Lanier, who is actually
right, he was on the show
in Berkeley, has written extensively about this, and I would recommend your listeners to read his books. He argues very convincingly what actually is happening with modern technology as far as, you know, a job environment is concerned.
Am I being too optimistic? I mean, when one looks at the primary product of Google has been Google Search, and of course Google Search has been amazingly democratizing. It enables a poor person to access, to harness enormous percentages of the world's knowledge at the same price, zero, as a rich person. So is it possible that Google's harnessing generalized and artificial intelligence may ultimately be democratizing?
It's both, you see, Marty. I think it both. It has amazingly positive effect. Of course, we can now share information. It's incredible. I mean, the kind of stuff we can... I use Google Search, of course, and Google Translate and all other amazing products that they have. I use them every day. So when I talk about Google, you know, criticize Google in regards to their secrecy concerning their, you know, development of artificial intelligence, concerning their employment of Mr. Kurzweil, etc., I'm not taking away from the incredible positive effect that they have had, Google has had throughout the world on all of us. So there's both good and bad. We should forget, we should drop this idea that somehow there is something which will only have good side, but no bad side. This never happens.
I'm just saying that I'm not talking about Google in general. I'm talking about the fact that if Google is obviously putting a lot of resources into the development of generalized artificial intelligence,
yes.
Is it possible in the same way as Google Search ended up being democratizing, is it possible, rather than this nightmare scenario, is it possible that that Google's understanding of generalized artificial intelligence will also be democratizing?
Well, but for what we know, they are not sharing their information. They're not sharing what the companies that they have bought, such as DeepMind, and they invested, you know, in Magic Leap recently, also about $500 million, you know. They're not telling us so much about what those companies are working on.
Anyway, I want to thank the caller very much, and because we're running out of time, and I'm feeling very self-conscious about interrupting the great Edward Frankel, but I'm also wanting to get my listener, there's a point of diminishing returns, you know, a calculus limit on every question, and
I agree.
And so I want to give the next caller.
You're the boss. You're the boss, Marty. So.
All our lines are lighted up, so you know I want to give a couple of more callers we only have 5 minutes left. So back to the phones. What is your question or comment for Edward Frankel?
Hey.
Hi.
Hey. Have you ever heard of an author called Morris Klein? He's a math teacher and an author who wrote in like the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. He's a great great author who also helps you love mathematics through history.
Oh, yes, I know. He wrote a book about history of mathematics, right?
Morris Klein?
Yes. Is that him? There is a book by Klein. I'm not sure which one it is.
So is there a soundbite about that, you know, that you want to share with us about that book that might add to our understanding of the field of mathematics?
You know, he wrote a book about called Mathematics in Western Culture, another one called Mathematics for the Non-Mathematician, and just pointing out how, like all kinds of stuff, like the Greeks were like looking at the rational order in nature, and it was later picked up again in the Renaissance. And
right. just, you know what? I mean, I'm going to really thank great. You for the call because our lines are lit up, and I'm trying to cram as much as I can. Thanks very much for the call. Back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Martin Emco, Edward Frankel. What's your question or comment for him?
Hi, I heard earlier when he mentioned that an individual has, infinite worth, and earlier he also mentioned reconciling science and spirituality. So I was wondering, could he explain what he thinks the individual's relation to infinity is? Because religion always comes at us with my creator is infinite, or a monotheistic conception of the infinite being their creator. So if an individual who doesn't share a religious conviction but also has a belief in science and a love of science, and they come at infinity through a mathematical perspective, and you say that an individual has infinite worth, I hear mathematicians always say there are multiple infinities, and how does a person stop being confused if they want to face another religious person and saying, well, I have a relation to infinity also?
That's right. Well, very good question. I think there are so many ways to connect to infinity, you know, so religion is just one way, and it's not by far not the only way. So, but mathematics is funny because so many people think that mathematics is the most boring subject, as we said earlier. But yet it is, in my opinion, it is one of the portals in sort of understanding the world, understanding the hidden sides of the world, you know, such as infinity. And, you know, let's think about it. Everything around us, the world around us, is finite. Even, you know, the number of atoms in the part of the universe that we can observe is finite. So ultimately, we actually... If we just, whenever we break things into small pieces like atoms, etc., we will always end up with finitely many of those. But there is also, but mathematics indicates that there is also infinity. So where is it? You see, where is it? And so, and the point is that there are certain things which cannot be broken into pieces, or you could try to break them into pieces, but then you kind of lose their essence. And so mathematics, when you study mathematical infinity, theory of mathematical infinity, I think it's one of the ways to approach that. But ultimately, I think each of us, you know, we have glimpses of that infinity when we come to the mountain peak and we look down and we absorb all this beauty of nature. You know, there are these fleeting moments when we connect to something bigger than us. But then immediately we start rationalizing and explaining, oh, wow, it's beautiful and so on. And so that fleeting moment, it kind of gets put into words and gets, you know, compressed into finite, projected onto finite. But in mathematics, it gives you a very cerebral way to access infinity as well.
Anyway, I want to thank you for the call. We are just about out of time. This show is about work, and we've tried to stay primarily on what is it really like to be a mathematician, but as a human being in the interface between the ineffable and the mathematical. But the show is about work, so I wanted to end with, by what does the word work mean to you now?
Very good. So I would say work in general, for me, it means effort. It means effort. And I believe that everything in life has to be has to be obtained with some effort. In other words, you cannot get it for free in some sense. And this is important. In other words, so for instance, if we just talk about our vocation, our just daily lives and our job, I think it's very important to do what you love. And I'm lucky, I feel like I'm very lucky that I get to do the stuff that I really love, you know, being a mathematician, teaching at UC Berkeley, etc. And I think it's very important. And so, but also work, I would say, you know, connecting to what we talked about earlier, it's also work, for instance, things like self-inquiry and learning who I am and about my past experiences, etc. I think that's also work. It requires work, and it requires kind of a deep looking inside, within.
Well, thank you so much, Edward Frankel, for giving us a look within you professionally and personally, the mathematical and the psychological. There's a much, you know, we do tend to stereotype people. As if you're a mathematician, you're going to be all about the numbers, and you are all
right.
You are at your center. You're all about the non-numbers, the ineffable. So thank you again. His book is, not surprisingly, Love and Math. It was a privilege having you on, Edward. Thanks very much. I wish you the best, of course.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Marty.
Great. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for your good questions. Boy, you asked as challenging a set of questions as one could ask even the great mathematicians of the world. In any case, please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will devote the entire hour to call-in workovers, that is, to you. I'll also intersperse my favorite new career tips, including 8 new rules for career success. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.